Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. It's Jobs Day Friday, so we got that going for us. And we will, because we always do, we'll do the week that was. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, today, the fifth day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The week that was. Coming up a little bit later in the program than usual today, because we begin with the most important four-letter word in this economy. It is, of course, J-O-B-S, jobs, about which we got the January report this morning. So, 17 days into a new administration, 36 days into a new year, 335-ish days into the pandemic economy, counting as we are from mid-March last year, this is where things stand. Yes, we added 49,000 jobs last month, and yes, the unemployment rate is down to 6.3%, but we are still nearly 10 million jobs underwater from where we started. And also, yes, I know that was a lot of numbers, but as I believe we've mentioned a time or two, and as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is about to remind us, numbers can tell you a thing or two about where an economy stands.
There are a lot of numbers in a monthly jobs report. It's kind of dizzying. So I asked each of the economists I chewed the jobs data over with today to pick just one indicator that shows where the economy is 11 months into the pandemic, one number that slams you between the eyes.
12.5 million.
That's Kurt Long, chief economist at the National Association of Federally Insured Credit Unions. And he's referring to the total number of jobs we're in the hole since the pandemic hit. In the jobs report, that's 10 million.
However, if we had not been going through what we've been going through the past nearly 12 months, the economy would have kept growing.
And Long reckons it would have added another 2.5 million jobs. Jobs needed to keep up with population growth for new high school and college grads, immigrants, new parents returning to work.
12.5 million jobs, that's an enormous deficit, of course. And at the pace we're going, it's just not nearly fast enough to eat into that.
And now, the number that slams Elise Gould at the Economic Policy Institute between the eyes.
3.9 million jobs down.
That's how many jobs we are still missing in the hard-hit and often poorly paid leisure and hospitality sector.
People who don't have an adequate safety net because their wages have been low for so long.
Now let's talk about unemployment. Officially, that's 10 million Americans who don't have a job and are actively looking. But Mark Hamrick at Bankrate says that doesn't count a lot of people who are not working because of COVID danger or childcare needs.
We have another 13 million who are either out of the labor force and want to work or who are underemployed, working part-time or would like to have full-time work.
Add them up, he pegs the total unemployed at about 23 million. That's about 1 in 7 Americans who had a job before the pandemic started. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
All right, so let's stay with the conceit of the top of the program today for just a little bit, if we might. Numbers, of course, and what they can tell us about where we are. The Labor Department says long-term unemployment is when somebody's been out of work for 27 weeks or more, a little bit more than 6 months. In this morning's jobs report, that was 40% of the people without a job in this economy, and that's not even taken into account people who've just given up and left the labor force altogether. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has a look at the long-term effects of long-term unemployment.
Early in the pandemic, there were lots of temporary job losses. Businesses were shut temporarily. People were furloughed temporarily and would hopefully get back to work eventually. But these 4 million people who are long-term unemployed?
That is exactly double what it was in January of 2020. So the economy, in my view, is really stuck in a rut right now.
Carl Van Horn teaches public policy at Rutgers, and he says unemployed people are stuck in a rut as well due to something called employment scarring, where the longer someone goes without a job, the harder it is to get a job.
Because employers tend to stigmatize them, even though we all know that most of these people lost their job totally without any fault of their own. They didn't do anything wrong. They were just caught up in this economic change.
And certain groups were caught up more than others. Women, Black and Latinx people. Kate Bond is the director of labor market policy at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth.
Workers tend to be displaced in really discriminatory ways. And then they're also going to face hiring discrimination on the other end. It's going to be even harder for them to go back to work.
A study out this week from McKinsey predicts inequities in the labor market mean it will take women and people of color an extra 2 years to reach pre-pandemic employment levels. Quaylen Ellengrood, who headed the study, says the pandemic has also sped up technological developments that make some lower-wage jobs obsolete.
And when you bring both COVID and automation together, you have a real acceleration and a much more slow rebuilding of jobs in the U.S. economy.
Plus, says Ellengrood, when people are out of work for a long time, they often just take whatever job they can get, even if it's not a good fit or pays less than they used to make, which can decrease wages in the future and increase stress and other mental health issues. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this fifth day of the second month. I'm going to say this, and you can fight me if you want, but the stock market has never been less the economy than it is right this very instant. Details, numbers, you know the drill. With the jobs report as a baseline, then, let us proceed to a discussion of that and the other events of this economic week as well in 6.5-ish minutes, give or take. Neil Richardson is the chief economist at ADP. David Gura is here as well. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai. Hi,
Kai. Neela, check me on this one as the actual economist on the panel here. Jobs the most important economic story right now?
Yes. Okay. Absolutely. And the key and interesting part of this very lackluster jobs report, yes, it stalled. The reporting you've done showing the multi-layers of that stall is really important. But also, this was supposed to be a good month for leisure and hospitality that was hit hardest during the pandemic. And that's because of this technical seasonal adjustment that happens that was favorable to hard-hit, highly seasonal sectors. So the fact that this didn't boost or inflate the job numbers this month is really telling about how deep the hole is that has been dug over the past few months.
Yeah, as Mitchell was telling us, David, 10 to 12 million jobs. No surprise, then, that President Biden is leaning in hard to his plan, right? $1.9 trillion.
Yeah, absolutely. So in light of today's numbers, Democrats, including the president, are really holding this up, saying, look, this is the rationale that we need. This should be convincing everyone that there needs to be a big stimulus package, another round of stimulus, another round of funding for folks who are out of work and need help. It struck me just listening to Mitchell's piece, hearing Mark Hamrick forecast that 23 million people are out of work since the beginning of this pandemic, that really the kind of through line through this week, through what we saw in today's numbers, what we saw from the CBO earlier this week, the Congressional Budget Office, has to do with modeling and how people are trying to figure out where we are, where we've gone, and where we're going as well. So your point is well taken. I mean, as we are at this very political moment, Democrats have the ability to push this big piece of legislation through. This is something that they are pointing to front and center, saying this is the rationale, this is why it needs to happen.
Okay, so Neela, let's pick up on something David just said, which is that Congressional Budget Office report out earlier this week, which said, and I'm paraphrasing here, the economy itself, that is to say gross domestic product, will be back to where it was a year ago by the middle of this year. Okay, that's the economy as a whole. But then it said the labor market will not be back until the middle of 2024. Can you help me understand how that can be?
The jobs market recovery is lagging the economic recovery. And the big reason why is fiscal stimulus. That has stimulated not job creation altogether, but stimulated consumer demand. So people bought more stuff, people invested in houses and in asset prices. At the same time, we're still seeing the jobs recovery struggle. Stimulus dollars did help in terms of helping small businesses get loans and extend credit, but it's lagging the overall economic recovery. Now, eventually, the jobs market becomes a weight on that growth. You can't continue to grow as an economy when you have 10 million people out of work. But for now, the CBO forecast actually contemplates this mid-year recovery back to pre-pandemic levels without any other dollar spent in stimulus. So regardless of what happens in DC in terms of new stimulus, that projection from the CBO is still for the economy to return to pre-pandemic levels this year.
Right. That's an important point about that CBO thing, David, that it's without more money. But look, let me ask you this. It's been a number of years since you were working for us in Washington covering the politics of this economy. Spitball it for me, right? This thing is going to get picked apart, this package. I will not hold you to this unless it's convenient for me to do so. But how big do you think this package is going to come in being?
I think it's going to be north of a trillion. Excuse me. Yeah. And I think that a large reason for that has to do with the legacy of what happened during the last financial crisis. And so something that sort of loomed large this week is this discussion about an op-ed that Larry Summers, the former Secretary of the Treasury, wrote, saying that he's worried about a package being too big and not targeted enough. And a lot of people have scoffed at that because they look back at 2008, 2009, and in hindsight, there's a sense that that package could have been bigger. And a lot of people fault Larry Summers for that. So I think that Democrats, maybe not writ large, but a lot of Democrats look back on what happened then, think there's a lesson to be learned from that. Again, they look at the politics such as it is now, where Democrats control the House. They have this edge in the Senate as well. I know that there's a debate over whether they should use this tool of reconciliation to get this thing through. But I think that that recent history really is something that a lot of them are thinking of at this moment in time. I was struck just listening to the rhetoric coming out of the White House, coming out of the administration today. It didn't sound to me like there were many or any people who were overly sympathetic to what the former Treasury Secretary had to say.
Yeah, no, not at all. And Jared Bernstein got up in the briefing room and said, no, I completely disagree with Larry. But look, Neela, let's interrogate this just for a second here, shall we? This idea that this package might be too big, according to some. And I don't want to look at it as congressional Republicans are looking at it, with a very conveniently timed emphasis now on debt and deficit, right? Which we all predicted would happen if a Democrat won the White House. Talk to me about it in terms of what the economy needs as it tries to recover from this.
Kai, first of all, thank you for allowing me to be an economist on this question.
That's why we have you on, Neela. That's why we have
Excellent.
You on.
Excellent. Well, I anticipated a little bit this, and I came up with an analogy. It's not the size of the quiver, but the direction of the arrow that matters.
Good.
And we need directed stimulus, because this is a K-shaped recovery. That means that there are sectors of the economy that have been hit harder. And in terms of the jobs market, it's low-income wage earners who have been hit hardest. Now, do we want to bring back the same low-wage jobs that were lost, or do we want to bring back better jobs? This is something that I'm not hearing coming out of a stimulus plan right now. So how do we construct and invest in infrastructure and broadband to bridge the digital divide in creating and retooling skill sets so that the jobs that we bring back are actually better, higher paying jobs? That would be a direction of that arrow in terms of stimulus dollars that could actually help the economy grow and workers be better off in the future.
Neela Richardson, David Gura on a Friday afternoon as we try to figure out the future of this economy. Thanks, you two.
Thank you, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. All right, so look, as Gura was saying, we are going to get some kind of relief package in the next month or so. $1 trillion, 1.9, who knows? What we do know is that there is still money from the last bill, the $900 billion package that just passed at the end of last year, that hasn't been spent yet. But does that matter? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore went in search of an answer. Depending on how you count it, the feds have put up about $4 trillion of pandemic-related relief so far. Loans, tax cuts, spending.
There's a lot of money still in the pipeline.
Mark Goldwein is Senior Vice President of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
About $3 trillion of that is out the door. The other trillion is either making its way out the door as we speak or is still waiting to be spent.
More than half of that unspent money is from the $900 billion relief bill passed in December. Michael Strain is an economist at the American Enterprise Institute.
And two big chunks of that are second draw PPP loans that have yet to be issued and unemployment insurance benefits.
Obviously, unemployment benefit money wouldn't be spent by now. You don't get March's unemployment check in early February. But with the PPP loans,
there is, I think, some uncertainty about whether or not all these funds will be spent.
Now, money not spent does not necessarily equal money not needed.
There are structural issues with the program. Not everybody can get a second loan.
Melissa Chang is with nonprofit Good Jobs First. Leftover PPP money is actually in an account sitting there. But other expenses, like unemployment, are more like Congress saying, we'll spend it if we need to. Mark Goldwein.
And if that ends up costing more than $120 billion, so be it. If it ends up costing less than $120 billion, so be it.
But whether this or that program spends everything it was expected to is actually a very different argument from how much total need is out there in the economy. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Three words, people. Marketplace Morning Report. Here's a couple more words. Check it out. Coming up.
There was bigger fish out there for me to fry, and I want to go out there and fry some of those big fish.
You go, huh? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials picked up 92 points today, 0.3%, closed at 31,148. The NASDAQ up 78 points, a little over 0.5%, 13,856. The NASDAQ, I just did that. The S&P 500 gained 15 points, just shy of 0.4%, ended at 3,086. For the week, the Dow up almost 3.9%. The NASDAQ rose 6%. S&P 500 pocketed 4 2/3%. Those are the biggest weekly gains since November for all three indices. Action camera maker GoPro missed fourth quarter sales estimates. Shares down 19%. Ouch. Bonds. Price was down. Yield thus goes up. That's the way that works. 1.17% on the 10-year. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there. I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. As Sabri was saying a couple of minutes ago, part of the already approved relief money that is not out yet is from the Paycheck Protection Program, the second round of it. And the guidelines for round two are a little more restrictive than for the first version. Loans are only available to businesses whose revenue dropped at least 25% the prior year. And the Small Business Administration cut the maximum size of businesses that can participate from 500 employees to 300. And as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, that definition of what exactly qualifies as a small business can get kind of heated.
The federal government generally defines a small business as one with fewer than 500 employees. Companies that fit that definition employ roughly half of the private sector workforce. They're eligible for many government aid programs, and they have a leg up when it comes to winning federal contracts. Karen Kerrigan runs the Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council, an advocacy group.
You know, there's $600 billion in opportunities. That's the amount of money that the federal government does with the private sector each and every year.
The problem with that 500-employee definition is that it includes about 99.9% of all businesses in the U.S. And even within that group, businesses tend to skew towards the tiny.
Well, 89% of businesses, you know, have fewer than 20 employees. And so we know that small businesses in America are really small.
And those businesses with fewer than 20 employees have very different needs than companies with hundreds, says Phil McCollum, a tax partner with the accounting firm Henry & Horn. He says smaller companies often need help with day-to-day operations.
They may rely upon us to do their payroll tax returns, sales tax returns. They probably don't have a full-time bookkeeper, so sometimes we'll have to help them with just monthly accounting.
Businesses with more than 20 people on the payroll employ a bigger share of the U.S. population. McCollum says those companies are generally more sophisticated.
They might have a full-time accounting staff. They're doing forecasting, printing their monthly profits and loss statements.
McCollum says he's usually answering broader questions for those companies.
In the sense of, hey, got some questions for you. We think we know how to fill out this payroll tax return, but we just want to understand the credit. We want to understand this question and why it's being asked.
The definition of how small a business should count as a small business has been contentious since Congress created the Small Business Administration in the 1950s.
I think it's misleading.
That's Véronique Desrougies at the libertarian-leaning Mercatus Center. She says a company with 500 employees just isn't what most Americans have in mind when they think of a small business or the kind of business that should benefit from government aid, like the Paycheck Protection Program.
You see, when you actually look at these companies that are big, that they actually don't have problems accessing capital.
But the right definition of small business depends on what problem the government's trying to solve. Is it a question of encouraging the creation of more small businesses?
Or is it more a question of we're trying to encourage total employment in the U.S. economy?
That's Paige Wiemei, a finance professor at the University of North Carolina. She says if, on one hand, the government's trying to encourage the creation of more small businesses, then it makes sense to target the smallest companies.
If, on the other hand, you're really trying to encourage employment within the small business sector, then you probably do want a large share of your benefits accruing to the larger fraction of firm sizes within the small businesses.
Wiemei says ideally, instead of a hard cutoff, the federal government would phase in small business benefits as employee counts go down. The federal government tends to stick with 500 because it's simple. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
We started the program today talking about jobs, of course, in the news this morning that this economy added less than 50,000 of them last month. And we are going to end the program today with a story about looking for a job from somebody in the business of helping people do that.
My name is Carolyn Kennard, and I am a regional facilitator for the Workforce Solutions. We go out to various organizations, whether it be churches, schools, or any organizations doing resume classes and interviewing classes. Ultimately, it is about assisting people in re-entering the workforce. Just to keep everything short and simple. Years ago, I was in the oil and gas arena, and I decided to leave, you know, the oil and gas arena. I felt that there was bigger fish out there for me to fry, and I wanted to go out there and fry some of those big fish. But it didn't turn out like that. I didn't realize it was the worst time for anyone to really be looking for employment. It was really tough for me. I started applying for various positions, and one in particular that I remember, oh God, I don't even want to think about it. I had never gone on a panel interview before in my life, and I walked in this room. There were seven people. I wanted to just faint or fall to my feet because when I saw those people, if I tell you, my heart started to race and they started popping those questions at me. But I got through it and I went to my car and I sat there for a minute and I started to cry. I really did because I said, you know, I thought I did everything right. I finished high school. I went off to college. And here I am looking for employment. And at that time, I probably had been looking for probably about 6 months. And I think then, you know, I probably started to beat up on myself. But I learned a valuable lesson because great things has really happened. I ended up going back to grad school and getting a degree in counseling, which I probably never would have gotten. All of us have to believe that in those moments that we feel there's no hope, there is something for everybody because we all have worth and we all have value.
Carolyn Kennard is a regional facilitator at the Houston-Galveston division of a nonprofit called Workforce Solutions. This final note on the way out today, a little bit of global macroeconomics to send you into your weekend because we like to keep it light, you know that. You remember how former President Trump used to fixate, among other things, on the trade deficit and him saying how big it is a sign of economic weakness and how we used to say every other or maybe every third time he did that, we would say, yeah, thing is, Mr. President, that's not the way the trade gap works. Cue up then this item today from the Commerce Department. Over the 4 years of the prior administration, the trade deficit in goods and services jumped almost $200 billion to its highest level since 2008. I'm going to say this again. How much we buy and sell to and from overseas isn't a weakness or a strength. It just is. All right, that's it. We got to go. Went a little long with Gura and Neela, so we got a boogie. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.